Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Your Everyday Cyber Podcast with Limor Kesem and Diana Kelly. We live in a cyberspace almost all the time, but do we know enough about living in it securely? Join this dynamic duo as they take you through an exploration of daily cyber activities and how you can make better choices to make them secure for yourself and your family. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to Your Everyday Cyber. I'm Limor Kesem, a cybersecurity professional and advisor. My co-host is Diana Kelly, a cybersecurity expert who is the CTO and co-founder of Security Curve. So online learning isn't new, but it really took off when the lockdown started. Although admittedly, I'm constantly immersed in online learning. I do it at work. I take external learning in cybersecurity. I get certifications, and I constantly see offers for learnings on Coursera, Udemy, and many others. I'm also developing a course now for online learning. So I guess you can say that I do know a thing or two about that. Diana, how about you? Did you have experience with online learning before, in the middle, and after the pandemic?
Well, it's interesting that you're working on an online learning piece, because I'm also working on some online learning right now for LinkedIn Learning. And I actually took some online learning myself a few years ago, but it was kind of a frustrating experience. You know, my fascination with canine ethology and how dog brains work. And I decided to take an online course in canine behavior a few years ago, but I got super frustrated because when the testing occurred, there were some bugs. It was clear they hadn't really software tested the online test tool. So there were some bugs in it. So I was kind of frustrated, and I really hope that nowadays that it's less buggy.
No kidding. Well, you know, I find that nowadays it's like a different generation where there's a different approach to online learning and a different approach to privacy of people who learn online. When you and I were in school, I didn't have access to such a rich online experience, if at all, actually, you know, only maybe in university, something kind of started burgeoning. So another element of online learning and schooling is actually something that could hurt children and tweens. And that's the risk of cyberbullying, for example. So it's one thing to gang up against a kid, let's say, when they walk home, but it's a whole other level when a child could be bullied nights and weekends at a whole different scale. So there's a lot to unpack and talk about here with regards to learning online. And we are so lucky to have Lisa Plagemeyer here with us. She's the executive director at the nonprofit National Cybersecurity Alliance, and she's going to walk us through the risks and rewards of online school. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So to get a first idea of the scale of online schooling, how many U.S. students are attending school remotely? And do you anticipate that number to go down after, let's say, most of the COVID transition from the pandemic is becoming like a little more endemic?
Yeah, I think the number is already dropping. I think a lot of kids are already back in school full time. I'm in Texas, and I know all of our neighbors that have young children, school-aged children, are really happy that their kids are physically back in school. Okay. So many parents struggled with childcare during the lockdown and when their kids were using remote learning.
Yeah. So even for non-remote learners, though, Lisa, is being online a requirement for going through the school system these days? You know, how is the internet part of modern kindergarten and student life?
Yeah, it absolutely is. The number of applications that are used in the classroom compared to when you were in school, or even the Stone Ages when I was in school, it's just the growth in that segment is incredible. The problem that we see there is that you know, people really get excited about the promise of technology and the way it can enrich the student experience. And we adopt all that technology very quickly, sometimes without thinking about teaching people how to use it securely. Only 60% of teachers and administrators, 40% of teachers and administrators have received any kind of training on their role in preventing a cyber breach. So, I mean, 60% haven't. And, you know, that's a problem. That means we're potentially in an easy target. So, you know, like many things in security, it involves slowing down just a little bit to make sure that you're configuring those applications to be more secure and more private. And then also teaching the teachers and the administrators and the students how to use those applications securely. And that boils down to some really simple things like password management. You know, the number of people that still write their passwords down or still use the same password on multiple applications just makes it really easy for the bad guys. And I think people are starting to understand, you know, what makes a less hackable password, a less crackable password is to have it be long and complex or be a passphrase. But then they think of that long passphrase that's easy for them to remember. And then what do? We use it on multiple applications and accounts. And the bad guys know that. So they'll try to use a password gained in one breach on other accounts. And that's how they find their way in. So we're a big advocate at the National Cybersecurity Alliance for password managers. Most of the password managers have family settings so that you can share passwords with your kids. So for example, if they're using some sort of online learning application that you know, tracks grades or that they use to submit homework, what have you, often it's, you know, parents want to check those things too. And so being able to share passwords on those accounts is super handy. And so to do it in a secure way, we recommend using a password manager.
We do too. And this is really interesting and more so because there was an IBM survey that spoke to consumers. There's a ton of new accounts that people created during the pandemic. And unfortunately, like you said, using passwords across multiple accounts, especially after opening a new account, is like, you know, eating food out of the garbage. Basically, the new account that's pristine and should not be compromised is already compromised because the password has been out there for like 2 years. So
right, exactly. Awful. Yeah, the other thing that I think people have been slow to adopt, and I wish more people understood, it's a lot easier than the name implies. Multi-factor authentication, I wish they would come up with a different name for it, because it's literally just having more than one way to prove that you're you, right? So that could be a PIN number that comes to your phone or any other type of authentication. But I think because we've given it this scary sounding name that sounds complex, more complex than it really is, it's, you know, adoption is a little bit lower than it should be. I did read the other day, and I don't remember who the giant technology company was, but it was somebody who had implemented enforced MFA on all of their users, and they haven't seen an authentication based compromise since. I mean, that just speaks awesome. Volumes.
No kidding.
That's I actually tell people, if you're using a small local bank or something that or any financial services account that doesn't offer MFA, that you should get a different bank.
Yeah, that might have been Microsoft. I think it was 99.9% of authentication based attacks went down in M365 when multi-factor was enabled.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's people, and people don't realize things that are that works. Simple that can make that big a difference.
It's a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And, you know, aside from opening a ton of new accounts during the pandemic, it definitely also made everyone rush for, you know, using collaborative tools and stuff they could do to study online. And, you know, schools went through this and it went widely and immediately to different platforms. But are there K-12 designated tools or platforms that are, you know, should be used for online schools? I mean, most schools are teaching remotely over Zoom or other things like that. We've seen attacks go, you know, Zoom bombing and whatever. So I was hoping maybe there was something more secure for teaching children.
You know, I think Zoom has made great strides. They took a lot of bad press early on during the pandemic when everybody was using Zoom, and they've added some different ways to use it more securely. I think that's what's key. Before I'd recommend people switching platforms, I'd recommend that they go into the settings and make sure that, you know, there's a password on the call before they set it up and things like that, just to prohibit anybody from being able to join that shouldn't be there, or to find their way onto a Zoom call that they shouldn't be on. I remember when WebEx and some of those technologies were brand new, and there were compromises with those as well. So I don't think it's about any one provider. I think it's more about how securely we use those tools. And, you know, what those of us in the security field would probably like to see is more of those technology providers having them be secure by default. So having the settings be set for better security and privacy out of the box, instead of your end consumer having to do it themselves. But we're not there yet. I mean, we're seeing slow movement in that direction. I think, you know, if I look at small businesses who don't have a lot of IT resources, or educational institutions that might not have incredibly mature IT environments or a lot of resources, having things sort of pre-configured to be secure, whether it's a cloud application or it's anything that they're using, I think if more and more consumers want that, then I think you'll start to see more movement in that direction. But I think right now there's some breach apathy out there. People feel kind of overwhelmed. They feel intimidated by terms like multi-factor authentication. And so they're not quite sure what they should be asking for. They just know that it's a problem, and people don't necessarily feel empowered. And that's really why our organization exists, the National Cybersecurity Alliance, because we're all about trying to empower people through education. And you don't need to be a technologist to have a conversation, you know, for instance, with your child's school about technology. You just kind of need to know what questions to ask. And so we have a lot of resources for parents on staysafeonline.org that can help.
Yeah, that's such a great point. It's so often it's not the app itself, it's how we use it. And education is critical there to using these safely and effectively. So when we're talking about school and K-12 particularly, a lot of these users, these students, they're minors. Are there any special rules about privacy specifically for minors that parents should know about?
I'd have to ask one of my friends who's a chief privacy officer and a privacy attorney if there's any legislation out there, or regulation, but not to my knowledge. I'm sure somebody listening to this podcast can correct me if they know of something. But what I would say is, I think when it comes to privacy, there's kind of two issues there, right? There's the privacy of our children with these companies providing these applications that are used in the schools. And then there's also this issue of parents feeling a little squeamish about, for example, checking their child's phone. So you talked about cyberbullying earlier. And I think, you know, parents get a little squeamish around checking their kid's phone, like just seeing what they're up to, because they don't want to violate their child's privacy. And the reality is that every social media app that your kid is using knows exactly what your child is up to. So you probably should too. And unless you're checking, unless you know, have an idea of, you know, what kind of texts or, you know, any of those are on your kid's phone or the social media apps, oftentimes you can find out, you know, way too late that your child is a victim of something like cyberbullying. So I kind of equate it to letting your kid play in traffic, you know, not having parental controls on their phone, not checking up on their activity on social media or texting, you know, pictures that are being sent around. I mean, I have a friend whose niece, unfortunately, she was 18. She had an inappropriate photo of another teenager on her phone who was under 18, and a judge sent her to jail for 6 months because that's considered child porn. So I don't think our kids, you know, any of us who are parents, I mean, my kids are contributing members of society. They're adults now. But those middle school years and those early high school years in particular can be really difficult. And every parent knows your kids' brains are developing, their brain chemistry is all over the place, their hormones are all over the place. So to think that you can allow them to be on the internet where there's great stuff, but there's also some really scary stuff, and not have any parental controls and not have serious conversations with them, very clear conversations with them about what's okay and what's not okay. You know, I think it's kind of irresponsible, to be honest. I mean, we really need to be paying as much attention to what our kids are doing in the virtual world as what they're doing in the as what they're doing in the physical world.
I really agree. It actually really set the stage for my next question. So at the top, we noted that it seems that children born after 2000 may have a different perception of online privacy. And I think that, you know, it's true. Are you seeing that it's borne out by data? And, you know, what kind of impacts should parents know about in the long run?
I see it in my own, I have one child that was born in 2000, and she's very apathetic about her privacy because she just figures it's all out there anyway. Her, you know, my data is in the hands of all the big tech companies and social media companies. So at this point, what do I care? And, you know, so then the way that as a parent that I counterbalance that is to try and talk to her about social engineering and helping to recognize when that text she got was a smish or when the email she got was a fish. It's a difficult situation. I think only time's going to tell what will happen when those kids get a little bit older. I have noticed, I have a child that's also a little bit younger, born in the late 90s, and she's very suspicious of what she sees online. You know, her attitude is different even than her siblings, and they're only 3 years apart. I think just teaching kids in general to have healthy skepticism, I can understand, you know, There's data on breach apathy and breach fatigue. It's like learned helplessness. You know, it's been documented. People just feel like I can't do anything about this, so why even try? So I can kind of understand my daughter's opinion because that's consistent with that research. What that's going to look like 10 or 20 years from now for people that have that kind of attitude, I don't know. We'll have to see where that goes.
Lisa, you had mentioned smished and fished, and we were wondering, well, first of all, if you could explain the different ways that the attackers are getting in. Are they kind of sliding into kids' DMs? Are they going on Instagram? You know, how are they phishing them outside of regular email? And then what are some of the red flags that parents should be looking for that, you know, that criminals are using to lure students and children in?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's just a ton of fake profiles on a lot of social media applications. My kids kind of joke about them because they feel like they're easy to spot. A lot of them are very recent profiles. You know, they've only been on Instagram for a short period of time, and that's kind of a giveaway. So they, you know, one of the best practices, and this is getting harder and harder to do, but especially for young children, I think it's important that they're not friends with anybody online that they haven't met in person. And I know that sounds like a real stretch these days when everybody's interconnected all over the world, but especially with young children, you know, they really shouldn't be, you know, hanging out with anybody online that they haven't met in real life. It's possible to get compromised through these fake profiles, and worse, you know, there's all kinds of creepy folks out on social media apps trying to get to your child. And then of course there's the smishing, right? There's the fake texts that come across that are usually have a link that'll lead you to getting a malware infection on your device. So I tell kids to turn on their spidey senses. If it doesn't look right, if it doesn't feel right, you know, it's getting harder and harder to tell if something, you know, first of all, if it's an email, obviously you look at the sender address and other clues, misspellings, things like that, links that look fishy. But it's getting harder and harder to tell because the bad guys are just getting better and better at crafting those things. So really, if it's something that's unexpected, you know, it's from somebody, you know, it's an attachment or a link from someone that you weren't expecting at all, or it just doesn't, oftentimes there's just something that doesn't feel right to the kid. And that's important to kind of hone in on that situational awareness when you're using technology.
So if you had to think of one thing that you wished every student or, you know, child, teenager would know to keep themselves safer online, that's like one impactful thing, what would that piece of advice be?
Boy, that's hard. Asking a security person to boil that down to one thing. That's a toughie because I've got two or three, but I don't know which one I would pick over the others. I mean, the two or three.
So we'll take the two or three.
Then we'll vote on which one everybody likes best. So first one is not using the same password on all your accounts and having them be long and complex. And so therefore using a password manager ultimately is the first piece. The second one is enabling multi-factor authentication. And the third one is looking out for anything that looks suspicious, whether it's a fish or a smish or anything that just doesn't feel quite right. Those are probably my top three. To be honest, with a small child, I think, you know, things like parental controls and the privacy and security settings on their devices and on their apps is also incredibly important. You know, there's no reason that, you know, a younger child with a phone that, you know, everybody should have to be able to see their location, for example, or, you know, I mean, kids are famous for putting a lot of photos in social media apps and
TikTok.
So I think that's really more less about the kid and more about the parents and how they're counseling with their child about what's appropriate and what's not. But those would be my top three. I think, you know, those are very tactical things. If I had to boil it down to one thing, it would be to have open conversations with your kids about these things. Do your research as a parent and talk to your child. You know, let them know that, yes, there's all this technology is great. It's great for the parent to be able to get in touch with your kid, you know, those days when things are really hectic and, you know, they've just had a extra long practice session, they're going to be late, or you don't, you know, you're just trying to coordinate all of our hectic lives these days. I mean, having kids with cell phones has been really helpful to a lot of parents and to just our daily logistics. But at the same time, you have to realize that there's a downside to a lot of it and just do your research and have open conversations with your kids about these things. Don't assume that it's all good, that it's all okay. You have to take action.
I agree. And there's a lot going on behind the scenes that parents need to get to know, be aware, intervene. It can literally, in some cases, save a life. So yes. Lisa, thank you so much for helping us understand more about how students can stay safe online. Thank you, our listeners, for being with us today. I do hope that this episode was helpful to you and it's going to help you understand what your online learners at home and elsewhere might need your support and vigilance with. If you like this podcast, please follow our streams and get involved. You can reach out to us on Twitter at @cyber_everyday or on LinkedIn if you wish to send us some questions in advance or suggest topics for upcoming episodes. You can also email us. We have youreverydaycyber@securitycurve.com. Our podcast page has more details for you and resources for each episode, including Stay Safe Online and other resources in line with what Lisa told us about today. So thank you everyone for tuning in and stay safe out there.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Your Everyday Cyber Podcast with Limor and Diana. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.